Star Wars, Dark Force Rising, by Timothy Zahn, continued. Cassette number 3, side 1. Sure, no problem. I'll send Duncan. He hasn't got much to do at the moment anyway. All right. The netting will be ready by the time he gets here. Carda gestured and Mara keyed off the channel. You know where the number 3 dump is? He asked her. She nodded. 412 was Washi Street, 3 blocks west and 2 north. Right. He peered out the window. Unfortunately, it's still too early for repulsor lift vehicles to be on the streets. You'll have to walk. That's all right, Mara assured him. She felt like a little exercise anyway. 2 boxes be enough? If you can handle that many, he told her, looking her up and down as if making sure her outfit conformed to local Rishi standards of propriety. He needn't have bothered. One of the first rules the Emperor had drummed into her so long ago was to blend in as best she could with her surroundings. If not, Lacton can probably make do with 1. All right, I'll see you later. Their townhouse was part of a row of similar structures abutting one of the hundreds of little market areas that dotted the whole congested valley. For a moment, Mara stood in the entry alcove of their building, out of the busy flow of pedestrian traffic, and looked around her. Through the gaps between the nearest buildings, she could see the more distant parts of the city vale, most of it composed of the same cream-white stone so favored by the locals. In places, she could see all the way to the edge, a few small buildings perched precariously partway up the craggy mountains that rose sharply into the sky on all sides. Far up those mountains, she knew, lived loose avian tribes of native Rishi'i, who no doubt looked down in bemused disbelief at the strange creatures who had chosen the most uncomfortably hot and humid spots of their planet in which to live. Dropping her gaze from the mountains, Mara gave the immediate area a quick scan. Across the street were more townhouses. Between her and them was the usual flow of brightly clad pedestrians, hurrying to and from the market area to the east. Reflexively, her eyes flicked across the townhouses, though with each window composed of mirror glass, there wasn't a lot there for her to see. Also reflexively, she glanced across each of the narrow pedestrian alleyways between the buildings. Between 2 of them, back at the building's rear where he was hardly visible, was the motionless figure of a man wearing a blue scarf and patterned green tunic, staring in her direction. Mara let her gaze drift on as if she hadn't seen him, her heart thudding suddenly in her throat. Stepping out of the alcove, she turned east toward the market and joined the flow of traffic. She didn't stay with it long, though. As soon as she was out of the mysterious loiterer's line of sight, she began cutting her way across the flow, heading across the street toward the townhouse row. She reached it 3 buildings down from the loiterer, ducked into the alleyway, and hurried toward the rear. If he was indeed monitoring Carda's place, there was a good chance she could take him from behind. She reached the rear of the buildings and circled around, only to find that her quarry had vanished. For a moment she stood there, looking around her for any sign of the man's whereabouts, wondering what to do now. There was none of the insistent tingling that had gotten them away from Mirkur at the last second, but as she told Carda, it wasn't a talent she could turn on and off. She looked down at the ground where the man had been standing. There were a few faint footprints in the thin coating of dust that had collected at the corner of the townhouse, giving the impression that the man had been there long enough to shuffle his feet a few times. A half dozen steps away, right in the center of another layer of dust, was a clear footprint pointing toward the west behind the row of townhouses. Mara looked in that direction, feeling her lip twist. A deliberate lead-on, obviously. Footprints in dust never came out that clear and unsmudged unless carefully planted. And she was right. 100 meters directly ahead, strolling casually along the rear of the buildings toward a north-south street, was the man in the blue scarf and patterned tunic. A not very subtle invitation to follow him. "Okay, friend," she thought, as she started off after him. "You want to play? Let's play." She had closed the gap between them to perhaps 90 meters when he reached the cross flow of traffic and turned north into it. Another clear invitation, this time to close the gap further, lest she lose him. But Mara had no intention of taking him up on this one. She'd memorized the geography of the city Vale their first day here, and it was pretty obvious that his intention was to lead her up to the more sparsely populated industrial areas to the north, where presumably he could deal with her without the awkward presence of witnesses. If she could get there first, she might be able to turn things around on him. Double-checking the blaster beneath her left sleeve, she cut through an alley between the buildings to her right and headed north. The valley stretched for nearly 150 kilometers in a roughly east-west direction. But at this point, its north-south dimension was only a few kilometers. Mara kept up her pace, continually revising her course to avoid crowds and other impediments. Gradually, the houses and shops began to give way to light industry, and finally, she judged she'd come far enough. If her quarry had kept with the leisurely pace of a man who didn't want to lose a tracker, she should now have enough time to prepare a little reception for him. There was, of course, always the possibility that he'd shifted to one of the other north-south streets somewhere along the way, changed direction, east or west, or even doubled back completely and returned to Carda's townhouse. But as she looked carefully around the corner of a building into the street he'd first turned onto, she discovered that his imagination was as limited as his surveillance technique. Halfway down the block, he was crouched motionless behind a row of storage barrels with his back to her, his blue scarf thrown back out of the way across his patterned green tunic, something that was probably a weapon clutched ready in his hand. Waiting, no doubt, for her to stroll into his trap. "Amateur," she thought, lip twisting in contempt. Watching him closely, not even bothering with her blaster, she eased around the corner and started silently toward him. "That's far enough," a mocking voice said from behind her. Mara froze. The figure crouched by the barrels ahead of her didn't even twitch. And it was only then that she belatedly realized that it was far too still to be simply waiting an ambush. Far too still, for that matter, to even be alive. Slowly, keeping her arms stretched straight out to her sides, she turned around. The man facing her was of medium height, with a somewhat bulky build and dark, brooding eyes. His undertunic hung open to reveal a light armor vest beneath it. In his hand, of course, was a blaster. "Well, well, well," he sneered. "What we got here? About time you showed up. I was starting to think you'd gotten lost or something." "Who are you?" Mara asked. "Oh, no, Red. I'm the one what's asking the questions here. Not that I need to, of course. That fancy stuff on top pretty well tells me all I need to know." He gestured with his blaster at her red gold hair. "Should have gotten rid of that. Hide it or dyed it, you know. Dead giveaway. Pardon the expression." Mara took a careful breath, forcing her muscles to unknot. "What do you want with me?" she asked, keeping her voice calm. Same thing every man real wants, he grinned slyly. A pile o' hard, cold cash. She shook her head. In that case, I'm afraid you've picked the wrong person. I've only got about 50 on me. He grinned even wider. Cute, Red, but you're wasting your time. I know who you are, all right. You and your pals are going to make me real rich. Come on, let's go. Mara didn't move. Perhaps we can work a deal, she suggested, feeling a drop of sweat trickle down between her shoulder blades. She knew better than to be fooled by the other's careless speech and manner. Whoever and whatever he was, he knew exactly what he was doing. On the plus side, she still had the blaster hidden beneath her sleeve, and she would give long odds that her assailant wouldn't expect that a weapon that potent might be small enough to conceal there. The fact that he hadn't already searched her seemed to confirm that assessment. But whatever she was going to do, she had to do it now, while she was still facing him. Unfortunately, with her hands spread apart, there was no way for her to get at her weapon without telegraphing the movement. Somehow, she needed to distract him. A deal, huh? He asked lazily. What kind of deal you got in mind? What kind of deal do you want? She countered. If there'd been a box anywhere near her feet, she might have been able to scoop it up with her foot and throw it at him. But though there was a fair amount of junk littering the street in this part of town, nothing suitable was within reach. Her half-boots were firmly fastened around her ankles, impossible to get loose without him noticing. Rapidly, she ran through an inventory of items she was carrying or wearing. Nothing. But the Emperor's intensive training had included direct manipulation of the Force, as well as the long-range communication abilities that had been her primary value to his regime. Those skills had vanished at the moment of his death, reappearing only briefly and erratically in the years since then. But if the sensory tingles and hunches had started again, perhaps the power was back too. I'm sure we can double whatever you've been offered, she said. Maybe even throw in something extra to sweeten the pot. His grin turned evil. That's a real generous offer, Red. Real generous. A lot of men'd jump on that right away, sure enough. Me? He lifted the blaster a little higher. I like staying with a sure thing. Even if it means settling for half the money? 2 meters behind him, piled carelessly up against a retaining wall, was a small stack of scrap metal parts waiting to be picked up. A short length of shield tubing in particular seemed to be rather precariously positioned on one edge of a battered power cell case. Setting her teeth, clearing her thoughts as best she could, Mara reached her mind out toward the tubing. On my pad, half a sure thing's better than twice a nothing, the man said. Anyway, I don't spec you can outbid the Empire. Mara swallowed. She'd suspected it from the first, but the confirmation still sent a shiver up her back. You might be surprised at our resources, she said. The length of tubing twitched, rolled a couple of millimeters. Nah, don't think so, the other said easily. Come on, let's go. Mara tilted a finger back toward the dead man crouched at the box behind her. You mind telling me first what happened here? Her assailant shrugged. What's to tell? I needed a decoy. He was wandering around the wrong place at the wrong time. End of story. His grin suddenly vanished. Enough stalling. Turn around and start walking. unless you're looking to spite me by making me settle for the death fee instead.
No, Mara murmured.
She took a deep breath, straining with every bit of strength she possessed, knowing that this was her last best chance. And behind her captor, the tubing fell with a muffled clank onto the ground. He was good, all right. The tubing had hardly even finished its fall before he dropped to one knee, spinning around and spraying the area behind him with a splattering of quick cover fire as he searched for whoever was sneaking up on him. It took less than a second for him to recognize his mistake, and with another spray of blaster fire, he spun back again. But 1 second was all Mara needed. His desperate blaster spray was still tracking toward her when she shot him, neatly, in the head. For a long moment, she just stood there, breathing hard, muscles trembling with reaction. Then, glancing around to make sure no one was running to see what all the commotion was about, she holstered her weapon and knelt down beside him. There was, as she'd expected, precious little to find. An ID, probably forged, giving his name as Dengar Roth. A couple of spare power clips for his blaster, a backup vibroblade knife, a data card and data pad, and some working capital in both local and imperial currency. Stuffing the ID and data card into her tunic, she left the money and weapons where they were and got back to her feet. "There's your twice of nothing," she muttered, looking down at the body. "Enjoy it." Her eyes shifted to the piece of shield tubing that had saved her life. She'd been right. The twitches of power, as well as the hunches, were back, which meant the dreams wouldn't be far behind. She swore under her breath. If they came, they came, and there was nothing much she could do except endure them. For the moment, she had other more pressing matters to deal with. Taking one final look around, she headed for home. Carda and Duncan were waiting when she arrived back at the townhouse, the latter all but pacing the floor in his nervousness. "There you are," he snapped as she slipped in through the back door. "Where the blazes?"
"We've got trouble," Mara cut him off, handing the Dengar Roth ID to Carda and brushing past them to the still largely disassembled communications room. Pushing aside a box of cables, she found a data pad and plugged in the card.
"What kind of trouble?" Carda asked, coming up behind her.
"The bounty hunter kind," Mara said, handing him the data pad. Neatly framed in the center of the display under a large 20,000 was Carda's face. "We're probably all in there," she told him. "Or at least as many as Grand Admiral Thrawn knew about."
"So I'm worth 20,000 now," Carda murmured, paging quickly through the card. "I'm flattered."
"Is that all you're going to say?" Mara demanded.
He looked at her. "What would you like me to say?" he asked mildly. "That you were right and I was wrong about the Empire's interest in us?"
"I'm not interested in laying blame," she told him stiffly. "What I want to know is what we're going to do about it."
Carda looked at the data pad again, a muscle tightening briefly in his jaw. "We're going to do the only prudent thing," he said. "Namely, retreat. Duncan, get on the SecureCom and tell Lacton to start pulling the drop apart again. Then call Chin and his team and have them go over and repack the stuff in the equipment dumps. You can stay and help Mara and me here. I want to get off Rishi by midnight, if at all possible."
"Got it," Duncan said, already keying the encrypt codes into the comm board.
Carda handed the data pad back to Mara.
We better get busy.
She stopped him with a hand on his arm. And what happens when we run out of backup bases?
He locked eyes with her. We don't give up the dreadnoughts under duress, he said, lowering his voice to just above a whisper. Not to Thrawn, not to anyone else.
We may have to, she pointed out.
His eyes hardened. We may choose to, he corrected her. We will never have to. Is that clear?
Mara grimaced to herself. Yes.
Good.
Carda flicked a glance over her shoulder to where Duncan was speaking urgently into the comm.
We have a lot of work to do. Let's get to it.
Mara would have bet that they couldn't reassemble their equipment in less than 24 hours. To her mild surprise, the crews had everything packed and ready to go barely an hour after local midnight. With suitably generous applications of funds to spaceport officials, they were off Rishi and to Lightspeed an hour after that. And later that night, as the wild Carda drove through the mottled sky of hyperspace, the dreams started again. Chapter 6. From a distance, it had looked like a standard-issue bulk cruiser. Old, slow, minimally armed, with very little going for it in a fight except its size. But as with so very much of warfare, appearances in this case turned out to be deceiving. And if Grand Admiral Thrawn hadn't been on the Chimera's bridge, Pelion had to admit that he might have been caught a bit by surprise. But Thrawn had been on the bridge, and had recognized immediately the unlikelihood that the Rebellion's strategists would have put such an important convoy under the protection of such a weak ship. And so, when the bulk cruiser's bays suddenly erupted with three full squadrons of A-wing starfighters, the Chimera's TIE interceptors were already in space and swarming to the attack.
Interesting tactic, Thrawn commented, as the gap between the Chimera and the Rebel convoy began to sparkle with laser flashes. If not especially innovative. The idea of converting bulk cruisers to starfighter carriers was first proposed over 20 years ago.
I don't recall it ever being implemented, Pelion said, feeling a twinge of uneasiness as he eyed the tactical displays. A-wings were faster even than those cursed X-wings, and he wasn't at all sure how well his TIE interceptors would handle them.
Excellent fighters, A-wings, Thrawn said, as if reading Pelion's thoughts. Not without their limitations, though, particularly here. High-speed craft like that are far more suited to hit-and-fade operations than to escort duty. Forcing them to remain near a convoy largely neutralizes their speed advantage.
He cocked a blue-black eyebrow at Pelion.
Perhaps we're seeing the result of Admiral Ackbar's removal as Supreme Commander.
Perhaps. The TIE interceptors did indeed seem to be holding their own against the A-wings, and the Chimera itself was certainly having no trouble with the bulk cruiser. Beyond the battlefront, the rest of the convoy was trying to huddle together, as if that would do them any good. Ackbar's people are still in charge, though, obviously.
We've been over this territory already, Captain, Thrawn said, his voice cooling slightly. Planting a vacuum-tight collection of evidence against Ackbar would have ruined him far too quickly. The more subtle attack will still neutralize him, but it will also send ripples of uncertainty and confusion through the Rebellion's entire political system. At the very least, it will distract and weaken them, just at the moment when we'll be launching the Mount Tantus campaign. At its best, it could split the entire alliance apart.
He smiled.
Akbar himself is replaceable, Captain. The delicate political balance the rebellion has created for itself is not.
I understand all that, Admiral, Pelion growled. My concern is with your assumption that Bothan on the Council can be relied upon to push things so close to your theoretical breakup point.
Oh, he'll push, all right, Thrawn said, his smile turning sardonic as he gazed out at the battle blazing on around the enemy convoy. I've spent many hours studying Bothan art, Captain, and I understand the species quite well. There's no doubt at all that Counselor Felia will play his part beautifully, as beautifully as if we were pulling his strings directly.
He tapped a key on his board.
Starboard batteries. One of the frigates in the convoy is easing into attack position. Assume it's an armed backup and treat it accordingly. Squadrons A2 and A3 move to protect that flank until the frigate has been neutralized.
The batteries and TIE wing commander acknowledged, and some of the turbo laser fire began to track on the frigate.
And what happens if Felia wins? Pelion persisted. Quickly, I mean, before all this political confusion has a chance to set in. By your own analysis of the species, any Bothan who's risen as high as Felia has would have to be highly intelligent.
Intelligent, yes, but not necessarily in any way that's dangerous to us, Thrawn said. He'd have to be a survivor, certainly. But that kind of verbal skill doesn't necessarily translate into military competence. He shrugged. Actually, a victory by Felia would merely prolong the whole awkward situation for the enemy. Given the kind of support Felia's been cultivating among the rebellion military, the politicians would have to go through another polarizing struggle when they realized their mistake and tried to replace him.
Yes, sir, Pelion said, suppressing a sigh. It was the kind of tangled subtlety that he'd never really felt comfortable with. He just hoped the Grand Admiral was right about the potential gains. It would be a shame for intelligence to have engineered such a brilliantly successful bank job and then not get anything of real value out of it.
Trust me, Captain, Thrawn said into his unspoken worries. I dare say the wasting of political effort has already begun, in fact. Akbar's staunchest allies would hardly have left Coruscant at this critical point unless they were desperately searching for evidence to clear him.
Pelion frowned at him. Are you saying that Solo and Organa Solo are headed for the Palanhi system?
Solo only, I think, Thrawn corrected thoughtfully. Organa Solo and the Wookiee are most likely still trying to find a place to hide from our Nogri. But Solo will be going to Palanhi, firmly convinced by intelligence's electronic sleight of hand that the trail leads through that system, which is why the Death's Head is on its way there right now.
I see, Pelion murmured. He'd noticed that order on the daily log, and had wondered why Thrawn was pulling one of their best Imperial Star Destroyers off battle duty.
I hope it will be equal to the task. Solo and Skywalker have both proved hard to trap in the past.
I don't believe Skywalker is going to Palanhi, Thrawn told him, his face settling into a somewhat sour expression. Our esteemed Jedi Master apparently called it correctly. Skywalker has decided to pay a visit to Jomark.
Pelion stared at him.
Are you sure, Admiral? I haven't seen anything from intelligence to that effect.
The information wasn't from intelligence, Thrawn said. It came from Delta Source.
Ah, Pelion said, feeling his own expression go a little sour. The Chimera's intelligence section had been nagging him for months now to find out what exactly this Delta source was that seemed to feed such clear and precise information to the Grand Admiral from the very heart of the Imperial Palace. So far, all Thrawn would say was that Delta source was firmly established and that the information gained through it should be treated as absolutely reliable. Intelligence hadn't even been able to figure out whether Delta source was a person, a droid, or some exotic recording system that was somehow able to elude the rebellion's hourly counterintelligence sweeps of the palace. It irritated them no end. And Pelion had to admit, he didn't much like being kept in the dark about it either. But Thrawn had personally activated Delta source, and long years of unwritten protocol in such matters gave him the right to keep the contact confidential if he chose. "I'm sure Cabalth will be pleased to hear it," he said. "I presume you'll want to give him the news yourself." He thought he'd hidden his irritation with Cabalth reasonably well. Apparently, he'd thought wrong. "You're still upset about Taenab," Thrawn said, turning to gaze out at the battle. It wasn't a question. "Yes, sir, I am," Pelion said stiffly. "I've been over the records again, and there's only one possible conclusion. Cabalth deliberately went beyond the battle plan Captain Aban had laid out, went beyond it to the point of disobeying a direct order. I don't care who Cabalth is, or whether he felt justified or not. What he did constitutes mutiny."
"It did indeed," Thrawn agreed calmly. "Shall I throw him out of the Imperial service altogether, or simply demote him in rank?"
Pelion glared at the other. "I'm serious, Admiral."
"So am I, Captain," Thrawn countered, his voice abruptly cold. "You know full well what's at stake here. We need to utilize every weapon at our disposal if we're to defeat the rebellion. Cabalth's ability to enhance coordination and battle efficiency between our forces is one of those weapons. And if he can't handle proper military discipline and protocol, then we bend the rules for him."
"And what happens when we've bent the rules so far that they come around and stab us in the back?" Pelion demanded. "He ignored a direct order at Taenab. Maybe next time it'll be two orders, then three, then four, until finally he's doing what he damn well pleases and to blazes with the Empire. What's to stop him?"
"Initially, the Isalamiri," Thrawn said, gesturing at the odd-looking tubular framework scattered around the bridge, each with an elongated furry creature wrapped around it. Each of them creating a bubble in the Force where none of Cabalth's Jedi tricks would work.
"That's what they're here for, after all."
"That's all well and good," Pelion said. "But in the long run..."
"In the long run, I will stop him," Thrawn cut him off, touching his board. "Squadron C-3, watch your port zenith flank. There's a blister on that frigate that could be a cluster trap."
The commander acknowledged, the TIE interceptors veering away in response. A second later, half a heartbeat too late, the blister abruptly exploded, sending a withering hail of concussion grenades outward in all directions. The rearmost of the TIE interceptors was caught by the edge of the fiery flower, shattering in a brilliant secondary explosion. The rest, out of range, escaped the booby trap unharmed. Thrawn turned his glowing eyes on Pelion.
"I understand your concerns, Captain," he said quietly. "What you fail to grasp, what you've always failed to grasp, is that a man with Cabalth's mental and emotional instabilities can never be a threat to us. Yes, he has a great deal of power, and at any given moment,
he could certainly do considerable damage to our people and equipment. But by his very nature, he's unable to use that power for any length of time. Concentration, focus, long-term thinking, those are the qualities that separate a warrior from a mere flailing fighter. And their qualities Kabauth will never possess. Pelion nodded heavily. He still wasn't convinced, but there was clearly no use in arguing the point further. Not now, anyway. Yes, sir. He hesitated. Kabauth will also want to know about Organa Solo. Thrawn's eyes glittered, but the annoyance Pelion knew wasn't directed at him. You will tell Master Kabauth that I've decided to allow the Nogri one last chance to find and capture her. When we've finished here, I'll be taking that message to them personally. Pelion glanced back at the entrance to the bridge, where the Nogri bodyguard Rook stood his usual silent vigil. You're calling a convocate of the Nogri commandos? He asked, suppressing a shiver. He'd been to one such mass meeting once, and facing a whole roomful of those quiet, gray-skinned killers was not an experience he was anxious to repeat. I think matters have gone beyond simply calling a convocate, Thrawn said coldly. You'll instruct navigation to prepare a course from the rendezvous point to the honor system. The entire Nogri populace, I think, needs to be reminded of who it is they serve. He shifted his glare out the viewport at the battle and tapped his board. Tai Command, recall all fighters to the ship, he ordered. Navigation, begin calculations for a return to the rendezvous point. Pelion frowned out the viewport. The modified bulk cruiser and backup frigate were pretty much dead where they lay, but the convoy itself was largely undamaged. We're letting them go? There's no need to destroy them, Thrawn said. Stripping them of their defense is an adequate object lesson for the moment. He tapped a key, and a tactical holo of this section of the galaxy appeared between their two stations. Blue lines marked the rebellion's main trade routes. Those sheathed in red marked ones the Imperial forces had hit in the past month. There's more to these attacks than simple harassment, Captain. Once this group has told their story, all future convoys from Sarka will demand upgraded protection. Enough such attacks, and the rebellion will face the choice of either tying up large numbers of its ships with escort duty or effectively abandoning cargo shipment through these border sectors. Either way, it will put them at a serious disadvantage when we launch the Mount Tantus campaign. He smiled grimly. Economics and psychology, Captain. For now, the more civilian survivors there are to spread the tale of Imperial power, the better. There'll be time enough for destruction later. He glanced at his board, looked back out the viewport. Speaking of Imperial power, any news on our ship hunt? We've had 5 more capital ships turned into various Imperial bases in the past 10 hours, Pelion told him. Nothing larger than an old star galleon, but it's a start. We're going to need more than just a start, Captain, Thrawn said, craning his neck slightly to watch the returning Tai interceptors. Any word on Talon Karda? Nothing since that tip from Rishi, Pelion told him, tapping the proper log for an update. The bounty hunter who sent it was killed shortly afterward. Keep up the pressure, Thrawn ordered. Karda knows a great deal about what happens in this galaxy. If there are any capital ships lying unused out there, he'll know where they are.
Personally, Pelion thought it pretty unlikely that a mere smuggler, even one with Carda's connections, would have better information sources than the vast Imperial Intelligence Network. But he'd also dismissed the possibility that Carda might be hiding Luke Skywalker out at that base on Mirker. Carda was turning out to be full of surprises. "There are a lot of people out there hunting for him," he told the Grand Admiral. "Sooner or later, one of them will find him."
"Good."
Thrawn glanced around the bridge. "In the meantime, all units will continue their assigned harassment of the rebellion." His glowing red eyes bored into Pelion's face.
"And they will continue, too, to maintain a watch for the Millennium Falcon and the Lady Luck. After the Nogri have been properly primed for their task, I want their prey to be ready for them."
Cabalth awakened suddenly, his black-edged dreams giving way to the sudden realization that someone was approaching. For a moment, he lay there in the darkness, his long white beard scratching gently against his chest as he breathed, his mind reaching out through the Force to track along the road from the High Castle to the cluster of villages at the base of the Rim Mountains. It was hard to concentrate, so very hard. But with a perverse grimness, he ignored the fatigue-driven pain and kept at it. There. No. There. A lone man riding a Kration Thumper, laboring over one of the steeper sections of the roadway. Most likely a messenger, come to bring him some news from the villagers below. Something trifling, no doubt, but something that they felt their new master should know. Master. The word echoed through Cabal's mind, sparking a wind-blown tangle of thoughts and feelings. The Imperials who pleaded for him to help them fight their battles, they called him Master too. So had the people of Wayland, whose lives he had been content to rule before Grand Admiral Thrawn and his promise of Jedi followers had lured him away. The people of Wayland had meant it. The people here on Jumark weren't quite sure yet whether they did or not. The Imperials didn't mean it at all. Cabalth felt his lip twist in disgust. No, they most certainly did not. They made him fight their battles for them, drove him, by their disbelief, to do things he hadn't attempted for years and years. And then, when he'd succeeded in doing the impossible, they still held tightly to their private contempt for him, hiding it behind those Isalamiri creatures and the strange empty spaces they somehow created in the Force. But he knew. He'd seen the sideways looks among the officers and the brief but muttered discussions between them. He'd felt the edginess of the crew, submitting by Imperial order to his influence on their combat skills, but clearly disliking the very thought of it. And he'd watched Captain Aban sit there in his command chair on the bellicose, shouting and blaspheming at him, even while calling him master, spitting anger and impotent rage as Cabalth calmly inflicted his punishment on the rebel ship that had dared to strike at his ship. The messenger below was approaching the High Castle gate now. Reaching out with the Force to call his robe to him, Cabalth got out of bed, feeling a brief rush of vertigo as he stood erect. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.